Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop on this snowy Thursday, February 9th. I'm Ray Graff. Time once again for the Science Forum, and we'll welcome back our esteemed scientists to the program to field all of your scientific inquiries. The lines are now open, 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. You can also email the program, voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. The scientists came here in the midst of the snow and all the terrible driving, so the least we could do is ask them some questions. And we'll start the show right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today we convene the Science Forum. It's an exciting day in radio history. We've gathered an esteemed panel of esteemed people to talk about esteemed topics. Yes, they're the scientists, boys and girls. And the number to call is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. You can also email the program, voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org. But again, that number, jot it down. 800, write it right on your hand, and then you, if you don't wash your hand, you'll have it for the next show. 800-348-2551 is the number. Now, let's meet our panel of experts.
Ed Stander, SUNY Cobleskill, esteemed scientist in astronomy and geology.
You look esteemed today.
I'm steaming.
And who's over here?
Jim Pickett. I'm a not particularly esteemed organic chemist.
We hold you in high esteem.
Well, you have low standards.
Yes, indeed we do. And then a newcomer, but not you've been here before, right?
I've been here many times before. I'm Michael Murphy, a biologist and ethicist, formerly from SUNY Cobleskill, but now from Zhejiang University in Hangzhou, China.
Really?
Really.
What are you doing here?
Taking a break.
Oh, nice to have you. Perfect weather for it. Well done. Good choice there, Michael Murphy. Well, the number to call again is 800-348-2551. There may or may not be issues with the phone system. It's getting to be one of those familiar refrains. But we'll find out. And in the meantime, we'll talk about boiling hot water, I think.
Well, I guess that's one of the things we could talk
is
about.
Is that what you brought that to the table, Jim?
Yeah, well, I brought other things to the table. This was actually more interesting, having to do with identification of the genes that make flavor components in tomatoes.
That's more important than hot water?
That's more important than hot water.
Oh, jeez.
Because a number of the genes that make the chemicals that taste good or smell good in tomatoes got bred out to make the cardboard supermarket tomatoes.
Ah.
But now those genes have been identified and through selective breeding, can be put back in.
Oh, terrific.
To make better-tasting tomatoes.
So when can I expect a better-tasting tomato?
I do not know that.
All right. Well, you get back to us on that. Now,
yep.
Michael Murphy, you had an interesting topic that you wanted to discuss today.
Yeah. Your audience may have read about these three-parent babies that have been coming up in the news recently.
Oh, yeah.
These are parents who... The woman usually has a mitochondrial disease. This is the small organelle in the cell that's responsible for energy production. And so the fetus and then subsequently the child will end up having possibly a lethal disease. So instead of just having sperm from the father and the egg from the mother, instead they take simply the nucleus out of the egg from the mother and they put it into an egg from a donor. And her nucleus is no longer there. So now it's three parents, three genetically different individuals, but the mitochondria are all from this donor mother. Now, the ethical problem is we don't know whether or not, because there's still a few maternal mitochondria present, we don't know if the offspring, when the offspring has a child, whether or not the mitochondrial disease will show up.
Hmm.
Well, my question, in all honesty, is who pays for the college education? Because that's a big one. When you have three parents, I mean, who's going to take responsibility?
Yeah, it is a big one, actually. And I think those things are satisfied with the kinds of contracts you see with parents who are infertile. At least one of them is infertile. Mm-hmm. And then the other parent gives up, the biological parent, that's the donor of sperm or egg, would give up rights to the fetus and the baby.
This whole business of designer babies, it's a sticky wicket from an ethical standpoint.
It is. I think especially with the advance of genome technology, it's sort of in line with what Jim was talking about. We can now cure some genetic diseases by replacing genes. And actually, the technology is getting much better with the so-called CRISPR system. We can actually very, very precisely spot genes, cut them out, and either replace or simply take out that segment and allow the DNA to repair.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum. Before we get to the phones, possibly, let's go to an email that came in. And says, I recently heard Bob Berman and Ray discussing if the size of the universe is infinite. If it is, wouldn't that contradict the Big Bang theory, since the universe would be expanding at the speed of light from that point and therefore be finite?
Wow.
We can go back to boiling hot water if you want.
No, that's okay. We can talk about that. There's a couple of really strange things about the universe that we don't understand. And one of them, of course, the idea of the Big Bang and the fact that there is, at some point, the universe cooled down enough from the time of the Big Bang to produce light. And this is a moment called the moment of photon decoupling. And we can actually see that in the record of the universe. And as a result, we know where that boundary is. So there is a finite size as far as that moment's concerned. But the weird thing about the universe is that as it's expanded, apparently, the density of the universe hasn't changed. In other words,
how is that possible?
That's a good question. Normally, when something expands, its density changes. It decreases, right? Yeah. A gas floats, a hot air gas floats because it's less dense. But in the case of the universe, it seems that the density is staying approximately the same. And one possible reason for that is that the universe may actually be expanding into a universe that's already there. And so,
how would you prove something like that?
Well, I'm not going to try.
Okay.
But whoever does prove it is going to wind up with a Nobel Prize to meet the band. But the trick is that possibly what's happening is just like in a crystal growth, when you have a whole a material, crystals can grow into other crystals, and the material from the crystals on the outside sort of force their way into the new crystal. So you get bigger crystals at the expense of little ones. And it's quite possible that's what's happening with the universe is that the universe may be expanding into a universe that's already there.
Huh.
And in that case, the universe is effectively infinite because it could be a universe inside of a universe inside of a universe.
Ed, I'm sort of interested in how you measure the density. And the question is, the further you go out to the supposed edge of the universe, mm-hmm. The data from those measurements has to be quite old, I would guess, in terms of the information hitting the Earth.
Right. Well, one of the biggest problems we have, of course, is the question of dark matter. Not to bring that up to any great extent, but the question is, does it have density in itself? But in terms of light, in terms of the stars that we see, the density of star material from where we are here to the edge of the universe is relatively constant. Not entirely, but relatively constant. So it's difficult to measure, but it appears that there's a value called omega that astronomers use to define density, and it could be less or greater than the density of the original universe, if you will, but it appears to be one. It appears to be the same as it was at the beginning.
All right, well, let's go to the phones. It is the Science Forum, and we'll give it a shot here. We'll give the old wheel a spin. Dennis in Saratoga. Dennis, you're first.
Oh, hi there. Thank you for taking my call. And what you were just speaking about is sort of relevant. I was reading A Brief History of Time by Stephen Hawking, and if I remember right, the center of the universe is where you happen to be. And wherever you are is the center of the universe relative to you. Is that correct? And I'm trying to get my head around that.
Well, effectively, at the time of the Big Bang, everything in the universe was at one point, correct?
And okay.
And it's been expanding ever since then. And we're within what that one point was.
In other
words, we're within the universe as the universe is expanding. And therefore, to a good extent, if you consider it, if you go back in time, everything being at one point, we were at the center of the universe. And as the universe expanded, then we're still within that central point. We're within that universe. Now, there's very little evidence that the universe actually shot out in different directions. In other words, it appears to have started as a point and it's grown as a ball, and that ball has effectively grown continuously just the same way. We say that based on the fact that the, the light from that early moment when the universe first became transparent is the same in all directions. We call that the microwave backscatter. So we're effectively within the center of the universe because the universe is expanding in all directions equally away from us.
And it's not a matter like it's where it gets hard to get wrap your head around it. It's not like it's expanding into anything. It's the whole universe is expanding. There's no such thing as an edge to the universe. It looks the same no matter where you are in it.
Does that help, Dennis?
I mean, it's just sort of, it's too
give
weird.
Me something
it's too
to,
weird to get your head around.
All right. Well, thank you very much. We appreciate the call.
Thank you for your time.
No, that's interesting. We had two calls, or we had two topics really about the universe right away.
It's the snow outside.
You think so?
Yeah. It leads people to be thinking about things internal.
Our number to call here is 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum today with Michael Murphy, Ed Stander, and Jim Pickett. Tell you what, Mr. Zach, let's take a break and then we'll come back and hit the phones once again if they work. Okay.
Support comes from Quality Foreign Car Care, Ballston Spa, New York, specializing in European car sales and service for over 20 years. QFCC.com. The Lake George Land Conservancy, Bolton Landing, New York, protecting the land that protects the lake, offering more than 32 miles of trails for hiking, birding, and outdoor exploration. HikeLakeGeorge.org. Colby Attorney Service, corporate formations, document retrieval services, court filings, and legal publishing for the legal and professional community since 1939. ColbyService.com. Empire State Youth Orchestras, presenting the world premiere of Play, the Youth Orchestra with Fireworks Ensemble, this Saturday at Proctor's Theater, Growing the Future of Music, esyo.org. And Stavros, helping people with disabilities achieve their dreams, offices in Amherst, Greenfield, and Springfield. Stavros.org for more information.
Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here, our Science Forum. Our number is 800-348-2551. And our panel of experts today, Ed Stander, Jim Pickett, and Michael Murphy. Where's Barbara Bravitz?
Yeah, I'd like to throw a big hello to Barbara, who's probably sitting at home right now saying that everything we've said so far is wrong.
I'd like to assure the audience we did not silence her.
No. No, we did not silence her. And she'll be back.
And she'll probably call in with a question sometime soon.
I would suspect you are right, sir. Let's go to Fred in Hurley. Fred, you're on.
Hi, Ray. Good afternoon, folks. I have a question regarding the moon's path. I've been a graveyarder for many, many years, and so get to follow the moon at night, et cetera. And I'm wondering how the other side of the planet gets to see the moon when we can see the moon in the daytime here. And it's a very slow traverse in the nighttime. And I just don't understand. There's something that I just can't understand about how the moon actually gets around us completely in a day kind of thing. And
okay.
So that the rest of the you understand what I'm asking?
Oh, yeah. It's pretty straightforward. The moon takes about 29 days to go around the Earth. So on a particular day, it's sitting effectively in the same spot for most of the time during a particular day. So when we see it during the day, sooner or later, the Earth is going to spin around faster than the moon is going, and they're going to see it on the other side. So basically, that's how it works.
Yeah, but if we're still viewing it on our side.
Ah, but we're not viewing it on our side. When it goes down on our side.
Oh, no. There are days when I can see it during the daytime.
Right. And then they see it at night. I'm sorry, let's try that again. We see it during the daytime. They will also see it during the daytime, but at that point it'll be night for us, and the moon will no longer be in the sky.
Ah.
So, effectively.
Ah, so
I'm sort of getting it. Okay. So as we're spinning, it's, you know,
it's staying in the same spot.
Yes, I got it now.
All right, Fred. Hey, okay, thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you.
See ya. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. 800-348-2551. And over to Mason in Niskayuna. Mason, you're on.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, I spent a lot of time couch surfing, watching various shows about space and whatnot. And one of the things that's quite perplexing to me is the relativity of time. And my question is, as somebody approaches the speed of light, time to them stays relative to them. But for other folks, it speeds up. So if I went to the moon and back at the speed of light, you know, time on Earth for people would go by quicker. My question is, we have velocity, you know, on Earth moving through space, our solar system's moving through space in the galaxy and so on. So we have some relative velocity within the universe. As that velocity slows to zero relative to everything else in the universe, what would happen to the relative time? Would it stop? Would it be infinitely fast? It's a concept that's very perplexing to me. Any light that you could shed would be very helpful.
Yeah, this all has to do with the relative, the speed of the observer and the two observers. Okay, so as far as any individual is concerned, the time is unchanged. The clock goes tick, 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 tick. But as we are observing the person traveling at near the speed of light, it appears to us as if his clock is ticking very, very slowly. And they would observe the same thing for our clocks, because as in implied by the name relativity, it's the matter of the speed relative to each other. So there is no absolute time in the universe. It's all, it is all having to do with the relative velocity, the relative speed of two observers. So let's say that someone goes from Earth to Alpha Centauri at near the speed of light. We see that as taking 4.5 years for them to get there. From their point of view, it takes many fewer ticks of the clock for them to get there. They will, in fact, believe that they are traveling faster than the speed of light because they got to Alpha Centauri sooner than they would have expected. But from our point of view, it still took 4.5 years. Does that help?
It does. It does. It's still a perplexing concept, and I'll noodle on it some more, but that certainly helps. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks a lot.
It takes a lot of time to get this thing figured out. It
takes a lot of time. Is time, so this is the fourth dimension we hear about, but is it just an artificial construct?
No, it's within ourselves. I mean, we have time, and that time is defined by ourselves. It's a universal constant. It's not universal. Because it depends on how fast.
So, how does that segue into this theory that the universe is a holographic projection?
I saw that theory.
I mean, it's so bizarre to read about this.
Yeah. I mean, you can pretty much say that in the world of the very small quantum mechanics and the world of the universe of the very large of relativity and cosmology, our little brains just can't wrap around it because it's not like anything that we have everyday experience with. So the people who are able to grasp this from the mathematics, they can have some kind of understanding of it. But for most people, and I include myself in this, if you try to think by analogy of what is this like, it's not like anything we have ever seen. So we have a hard time understanding and imagining it.
You know, it'd be helpful to have an astrophysicist on the show.
Do you know of any?
No, not really. All right, let's go to the phones. Maybe we'll find something on a different topic. Phil and Beckett. Phil, you're on.
Well, I do have a different topic.
Oh, God bless you.
Much more down to earth, so to speak. This is in reference to archaeological digs. And it seems that, and the operative word here is digs, I guess, because we're always digging down to successively older civilizations, for instance. And aside from obvious examples like Pompeii or Herculaneum, where is all this material coming from that's burying things up?
Ah, I like that question.
That is a very good question, and I pondered that myself. But you can see that it must happen because if you look at your lawn, if it's been around for a long time, it's now grown up where it's higher than the sidewalk. And it's not necessarily because the sidewalk has sunk, but the soil has in fact gotten higher. And this could be because of deposition of dust. It can be because of more organic material. I really don't know.
Well,
but the fact that it happens is...
I can give you one part of it, is that certainly back in the old days when many of these civilizations were operating, almost all of them were next to the ocean, and they were all next to rivers. And when rivers flood and oceans rise, then you get a lot of material coming over the top. So a lot of the things that happen are because that's simply where people lived, and as a result, it was the most likely place to have soil deposited. And of course, outside of that, soil does grow over time. Grass, when it dies, the trees fall down, all that produces humus, that becomes the next layer of soil. But generally speaking, it's mostly because of flooding associated. I would guess it's mostly because of flooding associated with the location of the people.
Well, Phil, thank you for that one. It's the Science Forum on WAMC, 800-348-2551. Fran in Schenectady is next. Fran, you're on.
Hi there. It seems as though when I was younger and it was a bright sunny day, the skies were fairly clear. And nowadays, it seems as though there's still dark clouds up there, and you see a layer of dark up where you're used to seeing just a blue sky. Is this due to pollution?
I would say certainly in China that's the case.
it seems as though locally there seems to be an awful lot of darkness.
I think there is a lot of particulate matter in the atmosphere, and it can travel a long distance. And then physicists and the astronomer can explain probably a little bit better. But it's perhaps that weather patterns have changed somewhat as well. But if you look at photographs from New York City from when – I don't know your age, but when I was young, I'm in my mid-60s, it was terribly foggy day and night. And now you can go to New York, and it's actually quite clear at night with very, very little evidence of this dark cloud.
Yeah, I think the atmosphere is actually quite a bit cleaner, I think, than it was when we were kids. It may be a matter of selective memory.
But a lot of it also has to do. Oh, go on.
Okay, thank you very much.
Go ahead. You want to follow up, Ed?
Oh, I was just going to say that a lot of it has to do with just scattering. For example, if you stand on one hill and look at the next hill, you'll see that it's purple mountains and majesty and all that, simply because the light coming in is being scattered by everything that's in the way. We're seeing further, but we'll still get a certain amount of scattering occurring no matter what.
This question came in via email from our buddy Rich Guthrie. Rich, I can't believe you're listening when you're not on. This question says, so I recall being told a long time ago that it takes more energy to thaw an ice cube than to freeze it. True? If so, what happens to the deficit? It's from Rich.
It's got to be the same. You're just moving the energy back and forth out of the ice cube. So you have to take a certain amount of calories out of the water to freeze it, and then that same amount of energy needs to go back in to thaw it out again.
Now, there is a point to that, though, and that is when you freeze an ice cube, you put it in a fridge or a freezer.
Mm-hmm.
And generally speaking, freezers have a certain amount of circulation, and the circulation will remove heat faster than, for example, if you leave an ice cube on a table, because there you're forming a laminar layer, which the air effectively is insulating the ice cube to some extent. So if it's I think it seems to me that if the situation is the same in both cases, then I think Jim is perfectly correct.
Yeah. And that's a good point, because if you put the ice cube tray in the freezer, and the freezer is very cold, right? Mm-hmm. So it's zero Fahrenheit. You're going to be, and with the circulation, you're going to be removing that heat quickly.
Mm.
Then the ice cube freezes and then gets cooled down to 0 degrees Fahrenheit. You take that out, put it on the table. It first has to warm up to 32 degrees Fahrenheit.
Before it starts to melt.
And then you've got to put in yet more energy. That takes a relatively small amount of energy, but then you have to put in yet more energy to make it melt.
So let's talk about an experiment then. If you had an ice cube tray and you froze ice cubes, but then simply moved it from one freezer to another that was at, say, 24C, that would essentially control that, yes?
Yeah, yep. Yes.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum on WAMC, 800-348-2551. If you're on the road, I hope you are being safe. Let's go to Richard in Colony. Richard.
Great segue. Here's my question about freezing water.
Okay.
I have a cabin up in the woods. It's real cold out at night. The water is still running, but it's 10 degrees out, 5 degrees out. Can that water that's running be colder than 32 degrees?
It can. It's called supercooling, but it would have to be perfectly pure water, because any particles that are in the water would allow nucleation to start. You probably heard, for example, of people sitting by the side of lakes where they throw a rock in the lake and the lake suddenly freezes all at once.
Huh.
Yeah.
That's because you're forming a nucleus with that rock as you put it in, and things mix up. In much the same way that if you take a bottle of Coca-Cola and you sit it on a table, it may not have many bubbles, but if you shake it, all of a sudden the bubbles come out. It's the same idea. If you have a nucleus there that can start things going, it'll happen. So you can get water that's below the freezing point, below 0 degrees Celsius, if you will. But that would only happen if the water is extremely quiet, and you've got very little particulate matter in it.
Yeah, and the flowing is an important part of that.
Right.
It's probably almost impossible to supercool
flowing
water. Just because.
Okay. Thank you.
To supercool, it does have to be very, very still. And
right. But it is possible around here to have rivers running or streams running at very, very low temperatures outside. But that's mostly because the water is coming from the ground into the stream, and it's above the freezing point.
Mm. Let's go over to Joe in Clintondale. Joe, you're on.
Hi. I heard a part of a report mentioning that there was R&D synthesizing synthetic digits for DNA. Do you know anything about it?
It's actually quite easy to synthesize DNA, actually in any code that you want. There are machines that do it today, and we've even made artificial cells. So, yeah, it's quite easy.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering about, what else was being done.
Yeah, it's a good question.
Great.
Well, thank you.
Wasn't there a move at one point to actually send secret messages using DNA?
Mm. Probably. I think there's actually been a number of them.
Yeah.
And it would work.
Sure.
It would work. I mean, a code is a code, and this is a great code and actually more complex than binary.
Mm. There's actually also some chemically related. There's been considerable progress in being able to design enzymes to carry out particular chemical reactions. If you can design the enzyme and know then what the protein sequence is going to be that you need, then you can synthesize the DNA and put that into an organism to synthesize that enzyme for you to carry out a particular chemical reaction.
Actually, the pharmaceutical industry is doing this big time today. Yeah.
Is that where they're talking about taking, for example, a cow and producing pharmaceuticals
From the milk?
From the milk.
Yeah. They do talk about that. I hardly ever see that in the literature anymore, Ed. It's because microorganisms are just so much more efficient.
Oh, look at me. It's a perfect example.
It's the Science Forum on WAMC, 800-348-2551. Our scientists today, Ed Standard, Jim Pickett, and Michael Murphy, and Jim in Adams, Mass. Is on. Jim.
Yay, Ray, you made it in.
Hell yeah, man. I've been here since 6:30. I'm all set.
All right. And the panel, just a little comment here. A fellow was asking earlier about how you know, ancient civilizations and sites get buried and where does this material come from. Many years ago in Organic Gardening Magazine, the columnist there, Eula Gibbons, who Johnny Carson would never leave alone, he kept joking about him, wrote a column about a Dutch merchantman or businessman back in, I don't know, maybe the 1600s or wherever, wanted to prove where does all this material come when a plant grows. So he took a young willow tree, weighed it, a wooden tub, and the dirt he put in there, and let it grow for a year, separated them at the end of the year, and weighed them again. And there was a great gain in weight for the tree itself, but there was no corresponding loss in the weight of the soil it was growing in. So he came to the conclusion finally that that gain in weight, all those carbohydrates we call them, or hydrocarbons that plants produce in their photosynthesis and growth processes, came from two sources: the air that the plant took in, it separated the carbon from the air, and then hydrogen from the water, when it separated the hydrogen and the oxygen from the water that it drank. So if you're looking at a plant, you're looking at a big, huge tree, you take a piece of wood, you can wrap on it, it feels like a piece of cast iron. But essentially, they and we are nothing but air and stardust.
I actually give that as an example in my class. I tell them, look at a tree, and then explain where the hole is that made the tree.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, Jim, thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. Our number here is 800-348-2551. We will take a short break here and then be back with the home stretch on a snowy edition of the Vox Pop Science Forum.
Support comes from Vermont Coffee Company, offering slow-roasted organic coffee in the brown paper bag at local grocery stores. Vermont Coffee Company, coffee roasted for friends. Agricultural Stewardship Association, presenting a screening of the documentary The Last Crop, February 23rd, 7 p.m. at the Madison Theater. Meet the filmmaker, local farmers, and more. agstewardship.org for details. The Hyde Collection, an art museum and historic house in Glens Falls, New York, open Tuesday through Saturday 10 to 5 and Sunday 12 to 5. HydeCollection.org. And Real Seafood Company, Wolf Road Colony, locally owned seafood restaurant and raw bar, realseafoodco.com.
Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you. It is 800-348-2551 if you want to make a call on this program. Our guests today, Michael Murphy, Ed Stander, and Jim Pickett. And it's Lou's turn. Lou in Newburgh, you're on.
Yeah. Oh, good day, gentlemen. I have a great time driving out on the thruway. Boy, the weather is something out here.
Yeah, be careful.
Yeah, yeah. I'm trying to drive safely and I'm stuck behind a snowplow, driving real slow behind a snowplow.
That's
I got a
spot.
Whole bunch of us all lined up here. We're barely moving, but I got time to talk to you on the phone.
All right.
Oh, good. So I got a question. And, there's some crazy driving going on.
All right, just don't swear, Lou.
Talking about Venus.
Okay.
Apparently now is a good time to observe Venus. You can see it with the naked eye, the third brightest object in the sky this time of year, I'm told. But I wonder, I guess until the end of the month.
All right.
Then you're going to have to wait 20 more years or something. I wonder, though, is it possible to see Uranus with your naked eye?
Okay, well, three things, if I may.
All right, go ahead.
Well, first of all, Venus is probably the brightest thing in the sky. In fact, it's easy to find because it's the first thing that shows up when it starts getting dark, and it's not too far from the horizon. But second of all, it's in the sky about 6 months of the year, so you can't miss it. So we don't have to wait for 20 years for it. And third of all, it's Uranus, and you can't see it with the naked eye.
Okay. Well, Lou, thanks for that. And Ed, thank you for clearing that up. Our number is 800-348-2551. Of course, Venus, it won't be 20 years. You'll be seeing.
No, it's up 6 months of the year.
Okay. What fresh hell do we have? It's Bob in Albany. Bob, you're on. Hello, Bob. Let's hit the button again. Bob, are you there? Bobby. No. All right. That's it for Bob. How about Joe and Troy? Joe, are you there?
I am here.
You're on.
That's a tough couple of acts to follow,
sure,
Ray.
Sure. Thank you very much.
Ray, I'd like, if I could, to go back to a question that was asked earlier about where does the material come from that covers all the runes that are always discovered. I had given that some thought myself, and I had my own little home-baked thought about it, which is the number of places that used to be, of the ones that remain, almost all of them got buried, and the ones that didn't aren't around. So that's why it always seems like the Earth might be expanding, but in fact what's happening is Mount Vesuvius is erupting, or you're discovering the catacombs. You're discovering things that are covered with dirt, because things that aren't covered with dirt get torn down and something else gets built.
What do you think, panel?
I think that's probably partly the case.
Dust comes in by the ton, right?
Yeah. And it's also a matter that worms keep bringing stuff up to the surface. And
that's true. I mean,
and Darwin, in fact, studied that, right?
Yeah. And if you go to a place next to a stream, for example, and you see an arrowhead that wasn't there last year, it's because the Earth is moving around. It's changing all the time.
Well, that's interesting. Well, thank you. This one came in via email from Marion, Massachusetts. Related to the buildup of soil over the Earth and time, I've been wondering if the diameter of the Earth now is larger than it was many thousands of years ago. If it is, how would Earth's orbital behavior have been different in the past than it is now? So, Mary.
Well, there's a guy named S. Warren Carey out in Australia who says the Earth is expanding. He wrote a whole book about it called The Expanding Earth, if you're interested in that. Generally speaking, most people don't believe it. As far as the Earth getting heavier, yes, it does get heavier by a certain amount of material coming in all the time from outer space. But there's not enough material outside of the sun in our orbit to actually cause enough friction to make us slow down enough to go into the in towards the sun. When the Earth was much smaller, when it was just a little planetesimal, it probably spiraled towards the sun, but it can't do that anymore because it's got too much gravity, too much inertia.
Mm. Our number here is 800-348-2551. Let's go to Kelly in, I think, Scaticoke. Kelly?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, are you on? Is this Kelly?
This is Kelly.
All right, are you in Scaticoke?
I am, yes, sir.
Well, gosh darn it, we have it right. You're on.
I have a question about gravity. I've been reading some sci-fi novels lately, and I just want to make sure I got this right. The Earth is spinning, and therefore we have gravity, and we are stuck to the Earth. That is correct, right?
No. We don't have gravity because we're spinning. Spinning and gravity are two entirely different things.
I guess I'm glad I called.
Nope, you would have gravity even without spinning.
What Einstein argued...
Why is that?
What Einstein argued was that gravity was effectively a distortion of space and time. If you can imagine a large rubber sheet and you stick a bowling ball on it, then the sheet will bend where the bowling ball is.
Right.
Right? Now, if you put a second bowling ball or something else smaller there, it'll be attracted towards the first bowling ball because it's already there. That effectively is what Einstein would argue is gravity.
And the effect is essentially due to mass. Is that not true? Or?
Yep. Right. Yep. Yes.
So the heavier bowling ball will create that rut or whatever that the other ball will go toward.
Will go towards.
Fascinating.
Yeah, and that distortion is of space time itself. So it's.
And anytime we can bring bowling into the show,
that's always good.
Well, thanks, Kelly, for that. We appreciate it. Over to Ryan in Red Hook. Ryan.
Hey, how are you today?
Good.
I'm curious, the announcement of metallic hydrogen finally being formulated in a lab, the announcement fairly recently. Have there been any developments as far as whether it's metastable? And they talked about like superconductivity properties.
As far as I know,
been anything new on that?
From what I've read in science, they haven't released it from the way this was produced was to put some hydrogen. There are two diamonds with a gasket, so there's a little space in between.
Mm-hmm.
So you can fill that with hydrogen and then crank down on these diamonds.
And diamond anvil.
And diamond anvil to create incredible pressures.
Mm-hmm.
Plus they cooled it down to somewhere very close to absolute zero. And they could see phase changes in the hydrogen.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that's known. Then it went to basically being quite shiny. It went through a period where it was opaque, and then it became shiny. Mm-hmm. And it's on the basis of it becoming shiny that it was claimed then that it was solid metallic hydrogen.
Mm.
That's disputed.
Okay.
And what they have not done yet is release the pressure from the anvils.
And
see what happens. Because they wanted to make some other measurements and publish this first. And it all seems to me to be kind of premature to be claiming what they're claiming about the metallic hydrogen.
But, so, Jim,
and it sounds like
weird.
A remarkably energy-intensive to even produce it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what they produced was just a tiny, tiny bit.
So this experiment is still going on, and it's still at that state right now?
At least the last that I read that.
And that's not to say that metallic hydrogen can't exist.
Right.
Because you have planets, for example, such as Jupiter, which are made up mostly of hydrogen and helium, yet they have a very, very strong magnetic field. And many people have argued that the reason the magnetic field is in Jupiter is because the hydrogen within the center is metallic.
Yeah.
Ah.
And in fact, that liquid metallic state is mm-hmm. is apparently well known, characterized, and accepted.
Right.
It's this solid metallic hydrogen that's the question.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. We've gone back a little inside baseball here on the program. Our computerized phone system is down. And so we're back to the old method of Vox Pop where we had post-it notes, and I don't know what order they're in anymore. Thank you. Thank you, Colleen. I'll just randomly. Chris in Westfield, Mass. Chris, you're on.
Good afternoon. Quick question for you. If you go out and you buy a bottle of water, unopened, sealed, and you put it in the freezer, go back to it 4 or 5 hours later, and you open it, why does it turn to slush from the top down, but it won't freeze solid? However, if you take a bottle of water and you fill it at home and do the exact same thing, the whole thing turns to an ice cube.
Go ahead.
That's effectively the same question as the lake, because what's happening is you're taking water which is relatively pure, and it's settled effectively, so any particles that are in there aren't even in suspension at this point. But to make a crystal of water, it has to have something to hook onto. It has to have a nucleus of some other material, because otherwise you can take water and freeze it down to minus 50 and not have it freeze. So, but they have that little curvature of nucleus, and that allows things to form. So in the case of the bottled water, it's much more pure than the tap water that you're getting out of your sink. And as a result, one freezes much faster than the other.
Okay. Well, thank you, Chris. We appreciate that. Over to Kim in Saratoga. Kim.
Hi. I have a question regarding water as well. I left my Brita filter on the counter in the sun. I came home from vacation, and there was algae at the bottom of the Brita filter. So I was wondering, where did that algae come from? Was it from the water, or was it from the carbon from the Brita filter?
Well, the spores from algae, and algae itself actually is in the air and actually even in water, and it only takes one or two microorganisms to begin growing. So it's probably there already. You probably drink algae every day, although quite minute amounts. But also, if you had a perfectly sterile fish tank, I mean absolutely sterile, and just left it, you'd get algae in it as well, simply because it's carried in on dust. So even in the filter, you're going to find that you'll probably have small amounts of microorganisms, although not enough to harm you.
All right. Well, thank you very much. We appreciate that. And over to Elaine in the snow. Elaine, where are you in the snow? Oh, it's Elgin. I'm sorry. Elgin.
Yes. I thought you were asking for me. Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call. My question is not really well formed because I really don't know how to form it, but I'm going to have a two-part question. My one part that I would like to know is, before the Big Bang Theory, I wanted to know what's the hypothesis of the mass itself? What did it consist of? And I'm asking if there was like life, or was it like big like soup, with all of the chemicals, carbon, whatever it is to create life in it.
Okay.
And aside from that, my second part of the question is, what was the atmosphere outside of that mass? Was there an atmosphere? I just want to know what's the hypothesis on that?
Well, I'll take a part of that. As far as science goes, there is nothing before the Big Bang. Science ends at an infinitesimal amount of time before the theoretical Big Bang.
And there was nothing else beside that one point, right? Isn't that the way the whole theory works?
Well, we have no idea because we can't go back that far.
Yeah. So anything talking about before the Big Bang is out of the scope of science.
All right.
The other part of it is what was outside of the Big Bang? We don't know. But again, if it turns out that the density of the universe is not changing over time, it's quite possible that what happens is what's called a brain, a B-R-A-N-E, where effectively is a Big Bang and then a second Big Bang in the center and a third one, and it goes out like a series of firecrackers. But we don't know.
Hey, Doug in Amsterdam, very quickly, you're on. Doug.
Are we still in Amsterdam?
Yep, you're on.
I wondered if scientists knew about the scientist march that's happening on Earth Day.
Thank you so much for bringing that up. Yeah. The march, yes, it's on Earth Day, April 22nd. It's not just for scientists, but those who support evidence-based information and research. It's very, very important. It's in D.C., but also there are local marches. And I did find there's an Albany Facebook page. I'm not certain that it's on the same day. I'm not certain it's actually on Earth Day, but thank you for bringing that up. It's getting very good feedback from both scientists and consultants. So thank you for that question.
All right, and this one came in via email from Mark, and interesting question. We know that we can catch the common cold virus from either from another person or simply touching a dirty surface where viruses may be. Similarly, we can get polio from swimming in water where the polio viruses may be. But what about the rabies virus? We know you can catch it from the bite of an infected animal, but are there external places where the rabies virus exists? Can it exist on surfaces similar to the common cold virus?
Well, fortunately, it's one of those viruses that is killed fairly quickly by simple desiccation. Nevertheless, it can be get rabies through the air. There was a case of a New York State scientist at the research labs, and he was working on rabies. Actually, someone in a lab next door or two doors down, and the rabies virus apparently came through the duct system. So viruses in general don't live very long outside of the body, but in this case, they can live for some periods of time. HIV, for example, in comparison, if you desiccate it, it simply dies. It cannot be infectious.
Is a virus actually alive?
It's a good question. The standard answer is no, but yet we talk about killing a virus. It needs a cell to reproduce in.
And how long can a virus, I always hear about microbes or some such on the outside of a spaceship being a concern on a trip to, say, to Mars? How long can a virus go into suspended animation, as it were?
I only know about Earth viruses, so I would say if they're on the outside of the ship, they're not going to survive the journey. But if you look at the interior, obviously, or even in the interior of, an asteroid, certainly it's possible to have, if there was cells on another planet or viruses on another planet, it's possible for it to survive under certain conditions.
Isn't ultraviolet, for example, a really good way to kill these things?
For most of them, yes.
So that would certainly do a job of it if it's on a spacecraft.
Indeed. But desiccation really is the quickest and the prime way that we get rid of viruses and bacteria.
Yep. And that's going to be true for many of them, but not all of them, because some viruses can be nicely crystallized, right?
That's true. And after they're crystallized, are they active again?
I thought that they were.
Some might be. I'd have to research that closer. Yeah.
Well, that's where we will have to leave it. And, boy, thanks. Thank you guys for coming in the bad weather. We want to thank Ed Stander, Jim Pickett, and Michael Murphy for being here. Thank you for listening and for all the great calls and emails. Support comes from Schenectady County Historical Society and the Historic Stockade, presenting World War I discussion series, winter lectures, workshops, now accepting reservations for spring tours, schenectadyhistorical.org. Mango Tree Imports, Saratoga Springs, New York, featuring global fair trade gifts, including chocolates and jewelry for Valentine's Day, mangotreeimports.com. And Interactive Media Consultants, LLC, celebrating 20 years, providing websites, branding, social media, and digital marketing to the Capital Region and beyond, imediaconsult.com. Thanks again to Michael Murphy and Ed Stander and Jim Pickett for being here. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Colleen O'Connell took the calls in the old school fashion. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, Chef Rick Orlando will join us for Food Friday. We'll get out some Mardi Gras favorites to help you prepare for the celebration later this month. You can also consider it a celebration of our record one-day fun drive this week. It's coming up tomorrow at 2. Right now, stand by for news.